tonight. Hal comes to share his story, and he was here a few weeks ago and came up and volunteered, and we were able to get him on the schedule tonight, and I'm so pleased to have him to come visit us again from Biscayne's Had Enough group. Let's get it up.
Hi, everybody. My name's Hal Foster, and I'm an alcoholic. These are to keep me on task. Those who know me know that doing this is the most terrifying thing in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous for me, for some reason. And I say that because if you happen to fall into that category, whether you are new or old, then I want to share with you that you're not the only one. Also, hopefully we'll find out in about 35 or 40 minutes that it won't kill you. But I'm not going to, you know, I don't want to get too far off on that one, you know. Tim asked me about a year, this Tim asked me to do this about a year and a 4 or 5 months ago. And, you know, I told Tim that at the time, I said, well, I've had some trauma in my life, and I'm just not ready to do that. And the truth is that I don't like to do this. I said no. And I got to tell you, my sponsor told me one of the first things he ever said was, never say no in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I lived with that and lived with that. And I thought, okay, I've got to get, somehow or other, I've got to get square with this thing about getting up and talking. And so I included in my daily prayers asking for help. Normally, I just ask for knowledge of His will for me and the power to carry that out. But I included, help me with telling my story. Now, you know, I think that being an alcoholic, what I expected was, you know, some white light and just I would become an orator and with no problems. What happened was that I had been asked to tell my story 3 times between the first of the year and now, before tonight. So that's the way that that God works sometimes in my life. I heard on the radio a month or two ago, on one afternoon on the way to tell my story somewhere else, that they had done a survey. Now, this actually happened. They said they had done a survey of people, of things that people feared in this country most, and that public speaking ranked number one before death. And the reason it caught my ear was because I could relate to that. But the guy went on to say that apparently at a funeral, more people would rather be in the box than at the podium. I was born in 1943 in Orangeburg, South Carolina, a little town about halfway between Columbia, the capital, and Charleston. That the important thing there is that I was born right in the middle of the war. And not a lot of babies were coming along then. Most of the baby boomers have birthdays in 46, 7, 8, 9, and so on. So I think I was an accident. Plus, I have a brother that was 9 years older than me. I was raised kind of as an only child, and I was pretty well spoiled rotten, except for my older brother who picked on me incessantly. Now, I don't blame any of my alcoholism on either my parents or my brother. I think that I was born with this illness. And as I get on further in my story, I will hopefully that will come clear. My recollection of my younger years is I had a happy childhood. I was not abused, nothing, you know, no problems, except that I remember feeling alone and afraid a lot. And I was self-conscious, scared to death of girls when I got up a little bit of age on me. And the first experience I had with alcohol was in the eighth grade. I think I was about 13 or 14. And they had a dance in the gym. And it was a big deal. It was not a formal dance. It was just a dance in the gym. But it was my first thing like that, and I was scared. And I remember, and I had pimples, and you know, at that age, you know, that's the way it goes. And I remember thinking about 3 weeks before the dance, please, please, that was another one of my prayers, you know, don't let me get any, you know, breaking out. Well, sure enough, you know, 2 days ahead of time, I got a big one right there. Okay. We're standing there, and they had some kind of music. This is way before any sound systems like they've got now. And so they had some kind of little record player, and the wallflowers were standing on either side of the room, and I was in that crowd. There were a few people dancing, and I didn't know what to do. So I stood there and stood there, and somebody went out in the parking lot, and a bunch of guys were out there, and somebody had brought a bottle, a pint, I guess, of Roma Rocket wine to the location. I think that was Boone's Farm of the day or something like that. But they were passing it around, and so when it got to me, I, of course, you know, I mean, hey, I certainly didn't want to not be part of that crowd. It was bad enough I couldn't be a part of the crowd inside. So I took a drink of that bottle of wine, and it tasted terrible. And I passed it on, and I got it down, and it made one more circle and got back to me, and of course I had another shot of it. And I don't know exactly how it happened or when it happened, but I went back in that gymnasium, and I was a changed person. I walked across that room, and I asked, I think her name was Millicent something or other, bless her heart, to dance, and for about 10 minutes, I was Fred Astaire. And, you know, and it was just fine. It was okay. It was really grand. And I spent 20 years chasing that. That was my experience with the fact that I didn't know how uncomfortable I had been until I had that drink of alcohol. And it is said that, I mean, alcohol is a chemical, and anybody that drinks it it's going to do something to them, you know. Aunt Edna at New Year's Eve every year has a couple of glasses of wine, and it has an effect on her. But it does something for us. And I was looking for it from that period on. When I was 16, my father, who was militant, he was good to me, but I was scared of him. He was very authoritarian and ran a strict household, and he died when I was 16. And I remember the main thing I felt about that was, and I've taken a look at this in years since, is that rather than being sad that my father died, I felt free. And I knew when in those 2 or 3 years before that if I ever got caught by my father with any alcohol in my breath, that I'd be in deep trouble. But when he died, I felt free, and I took a drink. I drank beer, and as often as I could with the guys. This was in the 50s, and we all drank at the drive-in restaurant. And somebody up there, we were 16, 17 years old, but that somebody up there was selling beer to us. And got drunk every night on the weekend and then occasionally during the week when I could. My college drinking was the same way. It got worse. Football games. I went to the University of South Carolina, and I remember most football games. I don't remember halftime at the football games. We had a party, a big New Year's Eve party at a motel where we had rented a suite, me and a bunch of my buddies. And I got drunk, and the next morning, New Year's Day, I woke up, and this suite had a little bitty ice box in it because it was a suite. Now, in these days and times, that's not a big deal, but back then, a little ice box like that was just the coolest thing in the world. And I woke up with that old familiar terrible hangover, and I thought maybe somebody had put a Coca-Cola in the icebox. And I opened that refrigerator, and somebody, I don't know to this day where it came from or how it got there, but in that refrigerator was a pint of 100 proof vodka and a bottle of Bloody Mary mix. And I remember thinking, I've heard of Bloody Marys. And I've seen people drink them in the morning. So let me give it a shot. And I mixed up one and drank it. And in about 10 minutes, my troubles were over. And from that point on, I always thought it was like Leonardo must have felt when he invented something great, you know. I really felt like I had discovered the meaning of life even more than, you know, when I first found the alcohol. So I began to drink whenever as much as I could. And in college, it is a lot easier to do that. However, it doesn't work, mix real well with the school. And I flunked out of school and decided to take a geographical cure. And what I really needed to do was to go somewhere and get myself together. And my decision on that was Fort Lauderdale, Florida. I went down there and I got a job at Pier 66, and the entire that place, that's where they kept all the yachts, and the entire operation was geared toward, you know, partying and drinking, and I made just enough money to pay my rent and buy a keg of beer every payday. And I preferred to drink alone, quite frankly, because I drank to oblivion. And I don't know what would have happened, but with that, except that my life seemed to be propelled by outside events, and it seems that the University of South Carolina had notified the draft board that I had flunked out of school, and this was in the middle of Vietnam, and the draft board sent me a letter and wanted to see me. I think it was something about a pre-induction physical or something like that. So I jumped in the car right quick and headed back to Columbia, got back in school, and and it's interesting, but I actually got my grade point average up to where I could actually graduate from school in about 4 semesters. That's, you know, that's just the alcoholic. You can do what you have to do when the heat's on. While at that particular point, I married the lady who will heretofore be known as the children's mother. Now, you know, I used to malign her a whole lot more than I do now, because as my sobriety has gone on, I understand that my God works through people most of the time, and he worked through her in a whole lot of different ways. But we got married, and we moved to Atlanta, and had a couple of kids. I had an office. I was in the insurance business, and I had an office in West End. And I will be talking a little bit about locations in Atlanta. For those that are new to town or not familiar with it, forgive me, but you know, it's part of my story, because my drinking got, you know, I crashed and burned in Atlanta. But I had an office in West End, and the office that I worked at was in West End, and I lived out on I-20. And we sold automobile insurance, and it was a rough neighborhood. And we would leave there. I'd leave there at night sometimes with thousands of dollars in cash in a briefcase. And there was a guy on the corner from our office, right up on Lee Street there. that had Al's sandwich shop. And Al was from New York, and he was nobody's fool. He knew that when he was counting his money at 8 o'clock at night, getting ready to close up, that he needed not to be doing that by himself in that sandwich shop. And me and the guys that worked at the insurance office, I was certainly displaying my budding alcoholism. So Al would buy, he had a brand new quart of whiskey every night, and would begin pouring as soon as we left the office, which was about 7 or 7:30. And I remember most nights going out I-20, I had to close one eye to make that white line come together. And would get home late and drunk. And so this didn't go over real red hot with the children's mother. And a couple of other things that I did. We had bought a house over near Fernbank, and she was a gardener. And back in the 70s, it was very fashionable to have these potted palm trees in the house. She had one that was, she was called a Dracaena marginata, we had the big pot like that, and it was going like this, and all was great. And the Dracaena began to look poorly, and that became a big topic there at the house, and she couldn't figure out what was going on. And so she was constantly working on this plant. And it seems that the den where the TV was and my lounge chair where I drank and smoked cigarettes was here, and the bathroom was down the hall here, and the Dracaena was about halfway in between. And so she stayed up one night and caught me at that. And I'm only telling you these things so that maybe, you know, if anybody can relate. Plus the fact that, she had certainly had reason to be upset with me. In the early spring of 1974, she took the kids and went back to Columbia to visit the family. And at the time, I had moved from West End and had an office in the Mutual of New York building, the Money Building, right there where Brookwood Station is. It's still sitting there. Every time I go downtown, you can't miss the Money Building because you almost hit it before you bend around to Atlantic Station. And it was Friday night, and I remember that I had that same kind of feeling that I had when my father died. Hey, I'm free. And I left the office, and I went down, and at the time, there was a place on Peachtree there at Pershing Point called El Mexicano. It was one of the few Mexican restaurants in town. For some reason, I went to the El Mexicano and was drinking margaritas. And I had a whole lot of margaritas. And I left there, and I lived over near the old GMHI off of Rock Springs, over off of Briarcliff over there. And every morning when I went from where I lived to the Money Building, I came through the old Ansley neighborhood, for anybody who knows the Ansley neighborhood, and would come out there at Pershing Point and go up to the money building, and then I went back home the same way at night, back, forth, back, forth. Now, you know that that Ansley area back there is a little convoluted. You know, the old joke in Atlanta is that they paved the cow paths instead of actually laying out streets. So it all goes like this. And when I came back up Peachtree and took a right there to get over to Piedmont, I got down there and I thought everything was fine, and then suddenly I didn't recognize the streets anymore. So I retraced myself and tried to get started again, and long story short, the more I went around in there, the more lost I got. I had a 69 Oldsmobile 98 Town Sedan. It was half the size of this room. I decided that maybe the wise thing, it was not spring to the point where there were any leaves on the trees, so there wasn't much foliage, and I could see lights on Piedmont, and I thought that maybe a good method would be to just kind of head toward those lights, and I could get over there that way. This is, of course, after 10 or 15 margaritas, or however many I had. At any rate, I turned into somebody's side yard, went through their side yard, into their backyard, and I got out of their backyard, and the headlights were shining out into nothing, and I got out of the car and looked, and there was a culvert about three times the size of this room that was lined with rocks, and I thought, well, you know, I could see Piedmont with the lights right there. So I got that big old Oldsmobile and tipped it over and got down in that thing. And the front bumper hung up. And so I kept backing up and I got sideways in it. And then I remembered, you remember that movie, The Great Escape with Steve McQueen? He was escaping from the Germans on a motorcycle. And he went down by a picket fence or a barbed wire fence and got going and went over a hill and jumped the fence that way. Hey, sound like a good idea to me. So I backed that old Oldsmobile up as far as I could get it and got going down through there and cut that wheel all the way to the right. And that car became airborne. And blam! Hit, and I was on the other side. And man, that was just what the alcoholic wanted, you know. I knew this was the right way to go with this thing. So there I was in this field. I could see the lights. I was getting closer. And I got all down through there. And I came up on a bridge. And I said, well, that's great. I know that's the bridge that goes to Piedmont, and I'll be fine. I got down there, and the bridge was about as wide as this table here. And the old car, you know, was twice that wide. But I thought, well, I had a few drinks, and so I'm sure it's just me. So I put the front end of that car up on that bridge, and I got up about there, and that was the end of it. So I got out and walked home. The next morning, I woke up to the phone ringing, and there was a voice on the other end that said, Mr. Hal Foster there. Said, yes, this is Atlanta Police Department. Do you own a 69 Oldsmobile? Yes. Said, well, you need to come get it. It's over here on the Piedmont Driving Club golf course. So I called a wrecker, and the wrecker guy came and got me, and we went over there, and, you know, we rode up, and the pro was standing there like this. And I got out of the truck and walked over, and we looked down. At that point, the golf course is kind of down off of the road, and we looked down. He said, "You had a rough night last night, didn't you?" I said, "Yeah." And you could look down through there, and apparently I had come out of the woods in that culvert back down the fairway, and you could see where I had the dew on the grass. You could tell that whole progress of that car. So anyway, and there were about 25 or 30 little old men with gray hair all down there, and that car had the cart bridge blocked, you know, and they couldn't get from the ninth to the tenth hole, and they were all backed up and mad in hell anyway. So, you know, I thought I'll just cover this up and everything will be fine, but I forgot that I charged the thing on an Amex card, and about 3 weeks later, the children's mother wanted to know what there was a wrecker charge while she was out of town, and so one more strike against Hal. Anyway, I was drinking around the clock. I would get up in the morning, and it was a race between whether I could get out of bed fast enough to get in the bathroom to lose what I had the night before, and then I would have to drink enough to where I could get ready to go to work, and work long enough to get to lunch, to go to have a three martini lunch, and then, you know, try to get from there to closing time. And I had a pint of vodka in the glove compartment. That was one thing I always, the only regret I've ever had about drinking in this program was that I was about 10 years sober and heard somebody telling their story, and they're talking about putting their vodka in the freezer. I never thought of that. Because, you know, you come out on a July afternoon and pull that pint of vodka out of that glove compartment, and it's like, you know, fumes coming out of your head. And anyway, the children's mother got me one morning when I could not get out of bed and said, okay, here's what we're going to do. I have researched some places, and you're going to quit drinking. And she had one place called Willing Way Hospital in Statesboro, Georgia. And I knew that there was a, you know, nut house in Statesboro, and Willing Way did not sound like my kind of place. The other place she had picked out was the Palm Beach Institute in West Palm Beach, Florida. That was my place. So anyway, I flew down there. Picked up a white chip at the meetings that they had. It was a drying out facility. And went through the motions, and my main concern the entire time was, by this time I had gotten, the old Oldsmobile had seen its better days, and I had a brand new Cadillac. And the only thing I could think about the whole time I was down there was that I wanted the children's mother to drive that car down there to pick me up when it was all over with, so everybody could see how well I was doing. The last thing they told me when I left down there was, get in touch with AA when you get back to Atlanta. I didn't. I lasted about 3 weeks. And I started drinking one Friday afternoon. And when the children's mother realized that I was drinking, she started raising Cain and gathering the children up. And I had a loaded gun, and I pointed it at him. So when I got here, I didn't have to sweat the insanity. Now, my kids were like 2 and 3 years old. Both of them say that they don't remember my drinking, but they do remember the years of the early part of the divorce. And the children's mother dropped me off in front of the old Biscayne room up on Dresden Drive at Peachtree. And I was laying in the recovery bed in the back there. And I heard this loud voice and somebody coming in there hollering about who the hell's, you know, where was it? Somebody said we got a new one in the back. Said, where'd it come from? Said somebody from NABBA brought him over here, and all hell broke loose then. And y'all, some of you may remember Maggie from the Biscayne room. And I was laying there and I thought, Lord God, you know, what has happened here? You know, this is where I've gotten. And I was at a point for me where I was ready to give up. However, I went to meetings and I was there for 3 days at the Biscayne room, and we had no cell phones then, and there was a payphone behind the bar, and one afternoon I borrowed a quarter from somebody and called the children's mother and was telling her how wonderful it was that I had found this program that, you know, y'all were showing me what my problem was, and that I had heard that there was another program that she could go to called Al-Anon, help her with her problem. She said, I found out what my problem was, and I got rid of it about 3 days ago. Now, I know that sounds like something I might have made up, but this is AA, and it's that she said that. I was so angry and upset with her that that's all I could think about. And one of my first experiences with the tools of this program was somebody said to me, she's an instrument of God. And, you know, she's not doing it to you. She's taking care of herself, and you're where you're supposed to be. And I had a huge amount of relief about that. Let's speed this up a little bit. And how it works, where it says A, B, and C, for me tonight, C, God could and would if he were sought, is the most important thing. And that's, you know, kind of what I would like to wind up here with. I was very fortunate that the day that the children's mother carried me to the Biscayne room was October the 15th, 1974. And I am very grateful to say that I have not had a drink since. after I was sober for about 8 years, I met someone here in the program at NABA. And we got married, and against medical advice, against AA advice, you know how that goes. But we were married for 25 years, and it was a very wonderful relationship. About a year and a half ago, Betty, who some of y'all knew, lost her battle with a terminal illness. And I called my sponsor and I said, I don't know how I'm going to do this. I don't know what's going to happen, but I don't know how I'm going to do this. And he said, you don't have to do it by yourself. But I had been a long time away from this fellowship, tending to business and taking care of her. And he said, the first thing you need to do is get back right in the middle of that program. And y'all welcomed me with open arms. There are good friends who have taken me under their wing. And it's a situation where it's kind of like life. You know, old Maggie used to say, "If what you think that just because you quit drinking, do you think that we are going to have a ticker tape parade or something?" life happens. If you stay sober long enough, the wonderful, joyous, and happy things come along, and the not-so-wonderful things come along. But the things that are the saddest ones are the things that make us stronger. Today, I went and picked up my 3-year-old granddaughter from day school and took her to her mother's office. And that's my regular duty today. Now, as far as I'm concerned, for a man who pointed a loaded gun at his loved ones 35 years ago, that is a wonderful thing. And it is because of you people, you know, and this fellowship. I have one daughter who I've not gotten along with for years. She really didn't take the divorce thing well once she got a little older and knew what was going on. And she and I never saw eye to eye. And I felt like I had lost a child. And so last October, I went out to where she lives in Albuquerque and spent a couple of weeks mending fences. And she and I rode all over the state of New Mexico and saw them. That is a beautiful place. And I said to her, I believe that everything that happens absolutely is the way that it is supposed to happen. Absolutely, 100%, no matter what. My life depends on that. Because if I'm going to give the old man credit when it suits me, then I've also got to believe that it's supposed to be the way it is when it doesn't suit me. And Alicia said to me, I never thought that I would hear those words from you. And that kind of started our fence mending and a whole lot of honesty between us. And on Thursday, I think, was Christmas was on a Thursday this past year. And on Monday evening, I was sitting at home, because normally I don't go to a meeting on Monday. And the phone rang, and it was Alicia. And she said, we talked for a minute, and she said, I just wanted to tell you that on my way home this afternoon from work, the oddest thing happened. I was thinking about your trip out here and our travels, and all of a sudden I realized that I missed you. And I never thought that I would ever hear that from that child. And that was my birthday present. I mean, my Christmas present and birthday and everything else last year. And once again, that was a direct result of following the directions. Because that's not something that I wanted to do. It was something that I knew that I needed to do. And it worked out really great. And now I have all my relationships are pretty much squared away now. So I'm very grateful to be here, and I appreciate the opportunity for doing this, and I appreciate y'all being here and listening to me. Thank you.
Good job, Mel.
Thank you for sharing.
You're grateful.
There's a lot of news going right. People needing what they doing without. While others living high, a big piece of the pie, so many they got it wrong. As for me, when I wanted too much, ain't never enough. I know how it is to live and die. Always fearing that I'm gonna run out. Keep the good stuff to myself. Hide it from everyone else. Save it for a rainy day. If you wanna have it all the time, gotta give it. If you want love all the time, give it to someone else. I want everyone around to see how much your love means to me. Baby, wear it on my sleeve. It'll never leave if I give it and just go.